Welcome back, everyone, to The Movie Palace, a new podcast, or a newish podcast at this stage, taking a look at the films of old Hollywood. As ever, I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and I'm delighted to be joined on this episode by one of the biggest movie fans, movie buffs I know, and her name is Paige Schechter. Hi, Paige.
Hi, Carl.
Nice to talk to you. I mean, obviously, we've podcasted a few times together elsewhere, but it's going to be a real treat today to talk to you about a specific film I know you're very fond of, aren't you? And the film is George Cukor's The Philadelphia Story from 1940. Of course, starring, I mean, a great lineup of stars, really. Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn, and James Stewart. Yeah, you're a big fan of this one, Paige, aren't you?
I am. This is one of those that you hold up so high that it's untouchable by other movies.
Before we get to the film specifically, let's talk about, like I said, you're a huge film fan and stuff. So, like, has that always been the case? Were you into films from, like, a young age? Or was it something you happened upon later? Tell me your kind of, your backstory there, I guess.
Yeah, I'd say I've always been into movies. My interest in them comes, first of all, from my mom. She had a very defined set of favorite movies. There were like a handful, and she'd watch them over and over, from like The Philadelphia Story to The Goodbye Girl.
Yeah.
And there were ones in there that I still love: Casablanca, North by Northwest, African Queen, Sound of Music, and ones I haven't seen since then, like Rachel and the Stranger or The Woman in White. My initial interest came from her. And then, you know, in the United States, there used to be late movies. So I'm in a business where I work late, and so I get home late. And if there were late night movies on, they were invariably these great old kind of classic movies. And I remember when the Missing Hitchcock films came back: Rear Window, Vertigo, Trouble with Harry, Man Who Knew Too Much, and my favorite, Rope. And I just watched them over and over and over again. So beyond that, I have sort of an obsessive nature. If I'm into someone or something, I have to watch everything I can get my hands on. And that's how I worked my way back to a lot of these great early movies. Because if you're going back with Katharine Hepburn, you're going to run into a lot of other great actors and directors and writers. And so I've just done that with a number of old-time Hollywood people.
Yeah, and like, it just leads you from one rabbit hole to another, doesn't it? You know?
Yeah, it definitely does.
But like, more broadly, I mean, because obviously we follow each other on Twitter and stuff like that, and you're kind of a general film fan though, aren't you? Because it's not just like the old stuff you're into, you're sort of keeping up with newer stuff as well, aren't you? And that's what it seems, anyway.
I'm really all over the place. If you're entertaining me, then I'm into it. I have a great affinity for movies of the late 70s, because that's when I was growing up.
Yeah.
And I love Wes Anderson. I think is just brilliant. I will watch any Wes Anderson movie. And I have this line that I say: my favorite Wes Anderson movie is the one I have watched most recently, because he's just so brilliant and you see so much in it. But I really, I can watch anything. You set me down in front of the TV with the popcorn, I'm good to go.
And let's talk about The Philadelphia Story then, because I know this is one of your personal favourites. So yeah, just tell us a bit more about this history you've got with the film. So it sounds like one of your mum's favourites. So that's, I guess, how you first encountered it. But it's one you've seen quite a few times over the years, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I had the VHS and then the DVD and now the Criterion. Each time the new one comes out, I'm like, gimme, 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 gimme. I'm such a huge fan of Katharine Hepburn's and the way she presented herself on and off screen. And this one, really, if you're going to say something is not most like Katharine Hepburn, because we don't really know her, we know of her, we know what, you know, who we think she is, this one just captures her so perfectly.
Yeah, this is like a perfect role for her, in my opinion anyway. I mean, in terms of me in this film, this is one I'd seen a couple of times before. I think the first time I saw it was on TV. It was years ago, and it was before the days of like HD and whatever. So, I mean, I liked the film immediately. But then when I got the Criterion release, which I don't know, I don't think we're in sync with the US, but we got it last year.
I think that's when it came out.
And so obviously I'd seen the film again when that came out, and I watched it again this morning, you know, which is Saturday morning as we're recording. And watching it again, it just reinforced to me, you know, this is such a great example of like a sophisticated comedy, and, you know, a comedy of manners, I guess, is what you'd call it, or I guess a comedy of like remarriage. It's all about like matrimony and stuff like that, isn't it? So I think it's good for this kind of era of filmmaking, because doing stuff about weddings, it's quite an effective way of like complying with the Hays Code of the time, the production code, you know, which kind of policed what you could do with like romantic relationships. So yeah, it's a great example of that kind of comedy, and it's a great vehicle for these three great stars, of course, Hepburn, Grant and Stewart. So yeah, just like in a nutshell, or overall, I suppose, how would you kind of sum up your thoughts on this film, Paige?
I definitely agree with all that. Are you familiar with the whole box office poison thing that was going on?
I am,
right,
yes.
Before this?
With Hepburn.
Do you want me to do a little bit about that?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so before this movie came out, she had had a string of kind of unsuccessful movies, which includes Bringing Up Baby with Cary Grant, which now is a legendary screwball comedy, but at the time didn't do very well at the box office. So both she and the playwright, Philip Barry, had been in this succession of personal flops, each for themselves. And Barry, who was great friends with Hepburn, wanted to write something for her. He used both her as a model for Tracy Lord and socialite Helen Hope Montgomery Scott. And together, I think he took a lot of the great aspects of Katharine Hepburn, and he's working her into a story where people get to sort of knock on her, get to knock her down a few pegs. I think at the time people thought Katharine Hepburn thought she was too, you know, above it all. And this movie knocks her down a few pegs. And I think that immediately was one of the things. I don't know if the public felt the same way, but it's one of the reasons people got into it the same way, you know?
Yeah, but the other kind of side of that is that I think her, like, charm and her humanity kind of shines through kind of nonetheless, doesn't it? So, like, as the film goes on, yeah, she kind of gets taken down a peg or two or whatever, but you can really see why, like, James Stewart's character is so, like, gets so besotted with her, I think, you know?
Yes.
Just to go back to, like, the box office poison thing, yeah. So, it, like you say, it's incredible that, like, something like Bringing Up Baby, which is beloved now, didn't really strike a chord with audiences at the time. And then I think that was, you know, all these unsuccessful films she had a string of them for RKO, you know, and Bringing Up Baby then was the last. She went to Columbia Pictures on loan to do Holiday. And again, that's another good one, you know.
I absolutely love Holiday. I think Holiday is so underrated. You know, people have discovered Bringing Up Baby, and that's great because it's totally worthy. But Holiday is an amazing movie that I love almost as much as Philadelphia Story.
Yeah, so again, it's kind of striking, kind of strange, like, that it didn't do so well. And yeah, let's talk just a little bit more about that, you know, this box office poison thing, you know, this ad in the trade papers, because it's one of those stories that kind of goes around, and I'd never read up on it too much until recently. I'd always just thought of it as a Katharine Hepburn thing, but in actuality, you know, the ad talks about a whole host of other people too. You know, it's like people like Joan Crawford and Mae West, and even some male stars like Fred Astaire. But I think the great thing about Hepburn is, I think just before the ad comes out, she uses her own money to kind of buy herself out of a studio contract with RKO, you know. And it just sounds like she was, like, incredibly, like, determined to kind of put these career difficulties behind her. I guess what the box office poison story means for me, it's like, you know, it shows you that the system had these kind of unsavory sides to it. But you also get the sense that somebody like Hepburn just had this, like, tenacity and resilience that kind of meant she could, like, overcome it, you know. So she's kind of a great figure, I think, in, like, that respect, you know.
Yes. And because she's so personable, she's got these great legion of friends. You know, she's got Philip Barry, the playwright, and she's got Howard Hughes, who bought her the play's film rights, and then George Cukor to direct, who's another great friend of hers. So she inspires these people, and in turn, they inspire her.
That's it, you know, because that's what I was kind of thinking about with the film, like as a whole. I think in the booklet you get with the Criterion, there's a quote where it calls the film an example of the studio system at its best. And I think it's what you were just kind of saying, really, that you know, you take all these individual elements which are like very, very good. So you get a great screenplay, which is just kind of like sparkling, like with great dialogue. You've got like someone like Cukor's like an extremely capable director. And then all these, you know, these three stars are great, but the thing that's so great with the Philadelphia story is that when you kind of mix them together and combine them, and everything's working, and then the end film, the end result is something that's like even greater than the like the individual parts. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. When you look at the ingredients here, you're like, there probably never should have been a doubt that this was going to be brilliant.
In terms of Hepburn, then, I mean, one of the things I like about this part for her is that, you know, she's got this like statuesque quality. They actually talk about it, don't they, in the film? So they kind of they make use of her like a beauty. They kind of refer to it, and they also kind of play around with it a bit. So you can see why this would be such a fun part for her. So I don't know if you had any thoughts on that, but also I know you've got a story about Katharine Hepburn, possibly something about getting an autograph from her. Is that right?
So when I was a reporter in Florida, I was assigned to interview this guy who had gotten autographs of everybody, you know, like any celebrity, personality, astronauts, musicians, movie stars. And I asked him about Katharine Hepburn because, you know, she's my favorite actress. And he said she does the greatest thing. She does not sign autographs, but she will sign the letter that says she doesn't sign autographs. And in doing so, he got her autograph. So he gave me the address he had for her, and I wrote her a letter not asking for an autograph, just to tell her how brilliant, you know, how inspiring she has been to me and how much I love the movies with Spencer Tracy. And she wrote me a letter that says, "Dear Paige Schechter," I don't care if she spelled Paige wrong, I really don't. "Thank you for your enthusiasm and the best of luck to you." Signed, and she signed her full name. In later years, she started abbreviating that, but this was 1989. It's on her own personal letterhead, and I have an autograph from Katharine Hepburn, which, you know, is probably the best possession I own.
So was it, did she miss out the I, did she, on page? Is
She
that
missed the I.
actually?
That's okay.
Yeah.
She could, I'll change my name spelling for her. Yeah, totally fine.
Yeah, no worries. So what about like the first part of what I was saying there was kind of about how the film like uses her kind of beauty, I guess is what it is, isn't it? You know, like this statuesque quality.
It uses all her great elements, and another one is her ability for physicality. Because, you know, at the beginning there's that opening pratfall where Cary Grant pushes her down, and I was watching the extras on Criterion, and George Cukor called that spectacular. You know, the way she fell, and later she dives into the pool, and that's obviously her and not a body double. She has this great physicality that she's able to bring to the part, which in doing so makes Tracy Lord a more expansive character, you know, gives her more life. And
Yeah, and like she played the role on Broadway, of course. And I mean, Hepburn made a lot of money from the play, is what it sounds like, you know. And then she ends up obtaining the film rights. I think the story is that Howard Hughes gave her the film rights, and they were kind of going out or something at the time, possibly. You know, she wouldn't countenance like selling the film rights to anyone who wouldn't have her as part of the package, you know. So again, it just sounds like what a determined like woman. And of course, it ends up at MGM. And like I think as an example of like an MGM film, this is a good one, you know, because they kind of had this reputation for like top-notch production values, and they weren't really associated with more like lowly stuff. So obviously like the setting of this film and the subject matter of it is a perfect fit in that respect. It ended up in the hands of George Cukor, like you said, the director. A very accomplished director, of course. Did a lot of stuff with Hepburn and did a lot of other stuff people will have seen too. So I mean, if we're talking like his whole career, we're talking stuff like My Fair Lady and like the Judy Garland version of A Star Is Born, Adam's Rib, to just give one more example with Hepburn, you know. What I've read here is he's at kind of a low ebb, though, because he'd been fired off of Gone with the Wind the year before. I think he'd had another film come out since, which wasn't doing too well, hadn't done too well. But in any case, this was a good fit for him, because this seems to me like it's a film of somebody who knows how to work with actors, because all the actors are great, aren't they?
Oh,
and
yeah.
The whole proceeding has just got a very, like, sure touch to it, like very deft or something.
Yeah, it's nothing is overdone. Everything is essential to the movie and progresses, you know, makes the movie move on. And there's nothing extraneous or nothing. You're just like, I wish this part would end. You know, it flows incredibly well.
When you consider the story, you sort of realize what an accomplishment that is, because let's just, you know, let's cover a little bit of the plot and stuff. You know, hopefully people listening will have seen the film before. But anyway, so Tracy Hepburn's character, she's kind of divorced Cary Grant's character, C.K. Dexterhaven. And so she's due to remarry somebody called George Kittredge. And there's a gossip magazine called Spy that wants to cover the wedding. So James Stewart's character, Mike, or Macaulay Connor, and Liz, played by Ruth Hussey, and she's really good too, they're sent to cover the marriage, the wedding, and they get some help from Cary Grant. But then also in the mix, you've got other stuff like, you know, Dexter's trying to stop the magazine from printing kind of a scandalous piece about Tracy's dad because he still loves her and so on and so forth. It kind of snowballs out from there, doesn't it?
It does. It does in the most marvelous way.
Yeah, because you've got things like, you know, people assuming like false identities quite hilariously when we're talking about like Uncle Willie and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, false identities or people swapping real identities or people pretending they know less than they actually do. And you've got like romantic interests that are kind of like moving around and fluctuating from scene to scene. So I guess the way I've like talked about it there, it sounds complicated, but it never really feels that way to me when I'm watching it. Do you know what I mean? It all kind of flows quite nicely and I always know exactly what's going on.
That's one of the incredible charms of it, the play, and then the screenplay by Donald Ogden Stewart, who won the Academy Award for, I think he once said, for doing the least amount of work that he ever had to do, and he won the Oscar for it. But it's no small chore to make all this stuff fit, all these pieces fit and flow, and it's incredible.
Do you mean like the least work he had to do because like the basics were there from the stage play? Is that what you, think?
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. So I think they'd opened it out a little bit, you know, for the film. You know, there's a scene where they take a car ride to the stables and stuff like that. But so that they sort of, you know, took advantage of the opportunities going to film gave them. But yeah, this is the kind of setup, isn't it? It kind of lends itself to like sparkling dialogue. I mean, I've selected a few favorite quotes. It was quite hard to narrow it down, actually. Do you want to give your favorite quotes first, Paige? Because I don't want to steal any of yours inadvertently.
Well, you do yours first, and then I have so many that I'll go with what I have left.
Okay, so one that just is quite a silly quote, but it's when Mike goes to visit the library, Jimmy Stewart, you know, and and he's talking to the assistant who's kind of talking, you know, in very antiquated language, and, you know, he kind of starts to play along and he says, "Dost thou have a washroom?" And something about the way he delivered that line just really,
yes,
I thought was very funny. So that's one. There's a very nice exchange somewhere between Grant and Hepburn that I liked, where he says to her, "Sometimes for your own sake, Red, I think you should have stuck to me longer." And she comes back and says, "I thought it was for life, but the nice judge gave me a full pardon." That I liked. And there's an early scene with Stuart and the character of Liz, you know, it's when they first go to the house,
mm-hmm,
and they're kind of overwhelmed by the size of it and, you know, the geography of the house and everything. And she says to him, "What's this room? I've forgotten my compass." And he says, "Well, I'd say south by southwest, parlour by living room." And I don't know, it's just Stewart's got a great comic touch in this film, I think. But yeah, those are my favourites anyway. And there are loads more I could have selected. How about you?
Well, I would have also chosen that line for Ruth Hussey, who I think is amazing in this. She has some of the best lines in the film, and I think it helps keep her character in the mix. You know, we're all focused on Hepburn and Grant and Stewart, but she's there, and you kind of want her to win too. And it's because she's so funny. Like, "I can't afford to hate anyone. I'm only a photographer." And the same scene you were just talking about when they first get to this big estate, and they're talking about that there's a phone line to the stables, and she says that's probably so they can talk to the horses without bringing them in the house, you know. And then later, much later, when after Dexter and Mike talk and he finds out that he can get the Lord family off the hook, Cary Grant says to her, "Can you use a typewriter?" And she says, "No, thanks. I have one at home." I mean,
That's right.
she's so essential to this movie. She makes it better than it would have been without her.
Yeah, totally. And I think she was rewarded for her troubles with an Oscar nomination as well, which is good to know. I'm conscious with something so funny as the Philadelphia Story, there's this temptation to kind of jump around and stuff, but we haven't really talked about Jimmy Stewart or Cary Grant yet. So let's talk a bit about both of those guys. So starting with Stewart, I mean, I've already discussed this on the podcast, I think, but he's one of my favorite actors. I mean, of all time, really, and especially of this era. I mean, what about you? What do you think of James Stewart in general? I mean, would you class yourself as a fan?
Oh yes, it's hard not to be a fan. I mentioned Rope earlier, and of course Rear Window, and I've mentioned at least three other, you know, Jimmy Stewart movies in the context of the Philadelphia Story podcast. He is just someone they could count on to deliver the goods, because you're with him, you're on his side. When you look at Macaulay Culkin on paper, this is someone who might not come off as favorable in other people's hands, because he, if you're talking about who's a snob in the Philadelphia Story, it's the reporter. You know, he's looking down. He doesn't think that Cary Grant knows where the library is, and he is shocked that Katharine Hepburn is reading his book, you
Yeah.
know. So on paper, Macaulay Culkin doesn't come off so well, and it's because James Stewart is so wonderful that you root for him and you're like, yes, go.
I mean, you've mentioned stuff like Rear Window there, and I think he had a great intensity that he could kind of tap into when he wanted to, Obviously, I think maybe for a lot of people, what they think of is his kind of folksy persona, and that's a big part of what was so good about him. But I think in this film, you sort of see that intensity in a sense, because it comes out in his kind of passion emerges, doesn't it, for Tracy. So I thought whenever Hepburn and Stewart were on screen together here, it was just a treat.
That's what is so great about it. You're not really sure which one she should end up with, because they both seem like they have these great attributes. And then when they're together, there's a very nice romantic element to it, where he is saying things she wants to hear, but not like Kittredge is wants to put her in a tower. And we're immediately like, okay, this guy who's supposed to be marrying her is like the guy who's going to finish last in this race.
Yeah.
He's got no shot. But when you see Mike and Tracy together, it's like, wow, that's right. They have a nice chemistry. And if Cary Grant's character never came back, they might have had a pretty happy life together, because they respect each other a lot. They don't take each other's bull.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you a scene I think is just brilliant. It's that kind of nighttime tryst they have, I think it starts, doesn't it? They're kind of dancing to some jazz music or something, and it carries on and it develops, doesn't it, into a really interesting conversation where, especially when he starts to gush about her, he says something about there's a magnificence that comes out of your eyes, in your voice, in the way you stand there, in the way you walk. You're lit from within, Tracy. So that's kind of what I was talking about earlier when I say, his intensity, his passion, but also you also really understand why he's falling for Hepburn, I think, and that whole dalliance, that nighttime sequence is just terrific, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Let's go to the other main man then, Cary Grant. Definitely shouldn't overlook him, should we? And I'll tell you what's interesting from my perspective is that when I was younger and I was starting to get into this kind of period of filmmaking, the 40s and 50s and so on. I mean, I liked Cary Grant at that point, but I wasn't as taken with him when I was younger, as I was with other male stars at the time, because I was much more into people like John Wayne or Bogart, even people like Gene Kelly. But then recently, I haven't been watching as much stuff with those guys, but I seem to have been watching almost nothing but Cary Grant films like in the last year or so. And I definitely would like put him up there as one of my favourites now. And I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just, I think this is my theory anyway. I don't know what you think, Paige, but I think it might be because I've lightened up in the last few years. You know, I've kind of chilled out. So now I'm responding much more to like him because he's got this like effortless ability to do comedy, isn't he? He's got this really like,
yeah.
I mean, he's good dramatically as well, but he's a great comic actor too, isn't he? What do you make of Cary Grant?
Well, the first thing you notice is how perfect the comic timing is. You know, he and how he's really listening to the other actors who are in the scene with him. And that's probably why the timing is so good, because he's so attached to them and what they're saying and reacting to that, rather than looking like he's studied a script and is ready to deliver his lines. It's so personable.
I mean, he's in a lot of notable films, of course. He did a lot of great stuff during his career. Yeah, so I kind of wondering, like, you know, if this is the great Katharine Hepburn role, is this the great Cary Grant role, or are we looking somewhere else for that? I don't know.
I think he kind of makes it that, again, on paper. C.K. Dexter Haven doesn't seem that dynamic, but it's the way that he... First of all, you see the chemistry between him and Katharine Hepburn, and that sort of elevates his whole story. But the way he reacts with everybody, Cary Grant does it so well that I would say it's one of his best roles, even though it may not look like it has as much substance to it as the Jimmy Stewart role.
Mm.
But did you know that he had his choice of both these roles?
I did not know that. So that'd be interesting to know how much he, like, you know, had to think about it then, wouldn't it? Whether it was an immediate choice or what.
It's pretty crucial to the movie that we don't lean too far Jimmy Stewart's way. And again, if it was someone that other than Cary Grant, who's so charismatic and has such a great connection with Katharine Hepburn, we might be leaning too far the other way. And I know personally, I never do. I don't want to speak for everybody, but I think she maybe could have been happy with either, but C.K. Dexter Haven is obviously her soulmate.
That's the thing, isn't it? Because that's what it kind of builds up to at the end. And, you know, so we get Tracy kind of rejects Mike's proposal, like, very graciously. Tracy and C.K. obviously get remarried. And it's a very good sequence, in my opinion. I mean, I'm happy, I think, primarily for Liz, because I like to think that when the film ends, there's then a nice future in store eventually for her and Mike. I don't know if that's how you see it, too.
Yes, I do. She has that lovely scene with Cary Grant before the whole pool denouement happens, where he asks her, why don't you do something about this? And she says, I don't want to get in his way for a while. And we get it. We're like, okay, she's going to let whatever happens happen. I think that particular scene, I wanted to ask you about this, actually, about C.K. Dexter Haven. What's his game here? He's trying to save the Lord's embarrassment. Was his plan always to get Tracy back, or did that sort of come along as the story progressed? And for me, when he has that scene with Liz and she kind of opens his eyes and makes him see things, I wonder if that's the moment when he said, oh, I'm going to get her back. What do you think?
No, I think I agree with that, actually, because surely he couldn't have seen that many moves ahead, you know, from the start of the film. I like to think of it that, you know, he gets into this situation, he does want to genuinely spare her embarrassment and all that kind of thing, and then it's like the romantic interest reawakens through the course of the story. I think that's how I see it. Right, what about this film then as, like, it's this depiction, isn't it, of, like, a well-heeled, like, society and so on, isn't it? And I think Mike says something quite astute at one point, because he says, like, the prettiest sight in this fine, pretty world is the privileged class enjoying its privileges. And, I mean, there definitely is something to that, isn't there? He's got a point, and I think it applies to, like, to movies as well.
I think what I love about it, and I might be getting off course a little bit here, is that we have this impression of what high society people would act like, and they don't. You know, they're funny, they play practical jokes on each other, they give each other the business, and the actual snootiest person in this movie is the butler who's watching over James Stewart to make sure
Taking a
he doesn't
spoon.
steal any of the wedding gifts. So it really opened my eyes about how they're people just like we're people. They just happen to have a lot of money.
And yeah, no, it's really funny, like you say, that they play up to it, don't they? Like that scene where the young girl comes in speaking French.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And she plays Lydia the tattooed lady on the piano,
Yes.
and and then Tracy comes in and starts, she says something about smallpox, doesn't she, or something?
She does. That's one of my favorite early scenes in the movie, because they know what Mike and Liz are doing there, and Mike and Liz have no idea that they know. So that, like you said earlier, it's one of these things that just rolls in upon itself and makes it sounds so complicated, but it plays so perfectly.
It does, because what's also quite funny is like Cary Grant's like plan doesn't last that long, does it? Because people kind of wise up to what's going on, you know, and
Right.
then everybody adapts. And like some of the funniest comedy I thought though is that stuff early on about the uncle and the father, and and you just it becomes almost this kind of French farce or something, doesn't it? Where the father turns up and he immediately has to pretend to be the uncle, and that's the
Right.
kind of stuff that has me like laughing out loud when I watch this.
Absolutely. I have one more scene that I want to talk about, and it's when Jimmy Stewart goes over to Cary Grant's house. It's first of all, it's a perfect inebriation scene. He does the inebriation really well, you know, tripping over the word leveler. Look, I'm not drunk and I'm tripping over my word. And he does, there was an improvised hiccup in there that Cary Grant improvised his reaction to. And when we talk about Jimmy Stewart's performance in this film, that's the scene that I really look at. I just go, wow. Here he gets to say things in perfect, you know, I'm drunk manner. Words slip out that wouldn't have slipped out at other parts of the film in front of anyone except like Liz, who he trusts. I just love how the two men play off each other. It's just perfection to me. That's what I hold up.
Yeah, so this is a great film. I mean, you used the word perfection earlier, so that's how you see it. This is like unimprovable. This is like right up there for you when we talk about greatest films and that kind of thing. This makes the list for you, does it?
Absolutely.
I mean, this was a big hit at the time commercially. It did well at the Oscars too, so let's just talk a little bit about that. So it was up for quite a few. It was up for best film, but it lost to Hitchcock's Rebecca. Hepburn was up for Best Actress, but she didn't win. Ginger Rogers won that year for a film called Kitty Foyle. So it was also up for Best Director, Best Supporting Actress for Ruth Hussey. There are a couple of success stories out of a night for the Philadelphia Story. So like you already mentioned, didn't you? You mentioned Donald Ogden Stewart won for Best Screenplay. And James Stewart won for Best Actor, which is nice. And I think there's a story he kind of said he didn't deserve it and that kind of thing, which is kind of. You can easily imagine those words coming out of Jimmy Stewart's mouth, can't you? But it's good that he
Right.
won.
Well, do you know the story there? Well, he says Henry Fonda should have won for Grapes of Wrath, which wouldn't have been a bad choice. I think he sort of underestimates his own performance here. But the whole story goes that he wasn't going to go to the Oscar ceremony, and he got a phone call saying, you better be at the Oscar ceremony, because that was before the time in which they sealed the ballots and the accounting firms and everything. So it was sort of, you're going to win, you better
Wink,
be there.
wink. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the film, it's left a great legacy. People still watch it to this day. I know this is one that, a few people mentioned this to me as one of their favorites, like when I set up the Twitter account for the podcast and everything. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to do it, like early on. It kind of was remade, wasn't it, in 1956 as a musical, High Society. Now, did you ever see that one, Paige? And if so, what did you
Yes.
make of it?
That's another of my mom's favorites. But we sort of part company there because I can't get away from this movie. I think it's a nice movie. It's got great stars in it. They do a great job. I don't really think of Grace Kelly as Tracy Lord. She's gorgeous, but that movie doesn't really do it for me. I know my mom loves it though, so extra plug for it.
I mean, I've only seen it once, and I might have actually seen it before the Philadelphia Story. I'm not quite sure, but I thought it was okay. I enjoyed it. I love Grace Kelly, and I think that's her last film, but I agree with you that, Hepburn's a much better Tracy Lord. But yeah, it's got a good cast, isn't it? It's not just Kelly, it's Frank Sinatra and Bing Crosby. I think the songs are all by Cole Porter. I mean, I can only remember one of the
Yes.
songs, though, which is Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? I can't remember any of the other tunes. But yeah, it's good, but it's not in the same league as the Philadelphia Story, is it?
Not for me, but I know there are a lot of people who like it better, and more power to them. I think everybody deserves their own opinion. It's all about what grabs you, what pulls you in, and the Philadelphia Story is what pulls me in. But High Society is pretty darn good too.
I mean, how many times do you reckon you've seen the Philadelphia Story page? I should have asked you that earlier. I mean, are we talking, we're definitely talking double digits, yeah? How high?
Yeah, we're talking at least double digits. We might be talking triple digits.
Well, I got some catching up to do then, haven't I?
What's your number?
Oh, I think it's just three or four, I think.
Oh,
No higher than that.
catch up, catch up.
Okay, so yeah, it's been fun talking about this one. People should watch it, definitely. It's a great one. On social media though, Paige, I mean, I know you're active online, and I know you've got like your own blog and stuff with your sister. I don't know if you want to give people a quick heads up on that before we go.
Sure. We are sibling underscore cinema on Twitter. We're also on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest, and we do hashtag 10-word movie reviews where each of us will, we don't always do the same movies, just what either of us has watched at any given time, and she's tilde L and I'm tilde P. And that's how you know which one of us has reviewed a movie. But we love all kinds of movies that, as Carl said earlier, we will watch anything.
All right, in terms of the podcast, you can find us at Movie Palace Pod on Twitter, or you can find the page I've set up on Facebook. Just type in Movie Palace, and I hope it should come up in a search fairly easily. Now, next time out, if our schedule stays in place as it is at the moment, the next movie we're going to be talking about is Mildred Pierce, starring Joan Crawford. But we'll see, because the plan for that one is we're going to do a live episode from London, because there's a Joan Crawford season going on at the British Film Institute, and we're going to hopefully go and see the film, and then head to a bar, and then talk about Mildred Pierce straight after. So, fingers crossed on that one, because I'm always wary of live recordings. They can go wrong, you know. But anyway, I hope you can join us next time then, listeners, when the curtain rises once more at the Movie Palace.